got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, how are you?
Doing well. Just got in from harvesting persimmons.
Persimmons.
Yeah, it's that time of year.
I don't know if I've ever had one, I got to be honest.
Persimmons are a very underrated fruit. The soft ones, they call astringent, because if you pick them prematurely, they're very nasty to eat. But if you get one that's sweet, it's like a water balloon full of honey. And fruit flavor. The problem is that you can't ship them. So we harvest them. Yeah, we harvest them into egg cartons and then sell them at local markets within a day or two. And they are sensational.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to have to try some. But in the meantime, let's dive into our stories for the day. So first up, researchers are trying to design a vaccine to prevent opioid addiction. Now, they've hit a roadblock in their research, but there's a broader question, and that is a vaccine like this a good idea? Next up, the COVID pandemic has exposed Africa's need to do a better job of battling neglected tropical diseases, but there's some structural issues keeping the continent from doing that. So we're going to get into how they can solve those issues before they can address these diseases. And then finally, scientists are using CRISPR to breed disease-resistant cannabis plants, and this could result in a steadier supply of medical-grade marijuana for people all over the world who need it. But Kevin, let's get into this story about an opioid vaccine. I had no idea that this was even going on, to be honest.
Yeah, it's actually not new news, but the recent developments are, and this is by Ed Kara at Gizmodo. It's why it will be so difficult to develop a vaccine to prevent opioid addiction. And the reason this is necessary is because opioid addiction has skyrocketed in the last two decades, mostly because of prescription abuse and both in the case of patients and physicians who perhaps are oversubscribing them. But also issues with heroin abuse starting to increase again. And there's medications that you can use to treat the abuse. There's a lot of limitations. And a lot of people just don't opt to use them. And things like methadone, they're addictive. Still, there's other aspects that are not helpful. Things like naltrexone, which is like if you're going through a heroin overdose, they can give you naltrexone and it instantly knocks out the heroin out of the opioid receptor, displaces it. It's a really neat compound, really fun chemistry, but that also doesn't work real well with everybody. And so why is a vaccine good? Is because vaccine, if you can vaccinate somebody to produce an antibody against the opioid, it is referred to as a pharmacokinetic antagonist. It binds the drug itself and takes the drug out of circulation, literally. And it slows its distribution throughout the body and brain. It attenuates the drug's effects, both in addiction and the immediate effects. And it lasts a long time. So all these other things like naltrexone or methadone, you have to continually administer this stuff. A vaccine, you get a shot, and for at least a few months, if not years, you're going to have an effect in working against the opioid.
So one concern I have about this, and again, I believe these are in clinical trials, so they haven't been commercialized yet, but one of the possibilities is that once you take a vaccine like this, for as long as it's effective, you can't use pain medication if you truly need it. And so that's one example we could get into of many. But what do you think of that concern up front?
Well, that is a concern, right? Now you've just diminished the ability to use an entire class of pain meds. And so I think vaccines would have to be administered to folks who were where addiction was your primary health concern and life-threatening, rather than other secondary issues. And, you know, maybe they, you know, wrap you in bubble wrap after they give you the shot and say, cool it, you know. But try not to have any. But the other big issue is that there are some pharmacological issues that happen. And this is kind of the big deal. And that is that when you give the vaccine, it seems like the body now starts to decrease the threshold to pain. So people get hyperalgesia. They're very sensitive to pain. And so that's the problem. You're taking out the drug, but now you're actually sensitizing the body to the pain itself.
Now, that can happen for some people, it just is from taking opioids, right? They just develop this hypersensitivity. And so they're worried that with the vaccine, you might get a similar effect. Is that correct?
Yes, similar. Yeah. The big problem is that it's actually due to the vaccine, the antibodies interaction with the drug.
Right.
And,
okay.
And so that's really the big deal here.
Okay. Now, another concern I've seen, and this is from people called harm reduction advocates. And I think their overarching concern is that you don't need to cut off people who are addicted to drugs. You need to effectively wean them off them. And we've talked about some of the issues that motivate that thinking a couple months ago on the show. But I guess their concern is that we're throwing all of the, and there's government money going to this. So we're throwing research dollars at this vaccine idea. And in the meantime, there are some proven strategies that help people kick these drugs. And these are being neglected. Is there some truth to that? I know you've had some personal experience with people who are, you know, afflicted by this.
Yeah, and I think that's the big problem, is that it's hard to paint this with a broad brush. You have some people who are addicted that are non-compliant with taking other medications or therapies or other types of counseling, and you can't do much with them. And maybe something like the vaccination has a role in their treatment. But I think it's one of these things where we tend to look at something like addiction in a very generic context, whereas it really is a very specific issue that varies from patient to patient. There's mental factors, behavioral factors, individual chemistry, individual metabolism, other life issues. And so it's really hard to say what the right thing is. But the exciting thing about the vaccine is that it's another arrow in the quiver of physicians who would be able to use it in the most appropriate instances, if it worked.
Sure, sure. That seems to be, you know, a general theme here, is it's the application that's either good or bad. The technology is what it is, and then depending on how we apply it. And I think, now that I'm saying that out loud, I think that's where my concerns stem from. It's, you know, will your insurance company pay for this? Or can a federal court or a state court mandate that you take this vaccine if you're convicted of a drug offense? You know, these kinds of things, these are way beyond the science or a topic that we could address. But I think that's where most of the concern lies.
No, you're exactly right. It's technology is really cool stuff. It's how we use it. And, you know, that's the discussion that we have all the time with people, whether it's, you know, genetic engineering or artificial hearts or in vitro fertilization at one time. You know, should we do it just because we can do it? And in this case, I think it's good to develop another tool, test it, make sure it works or know its limitations, and at least allow physicians to use it where it's most appropriate. It's really important that we do that.
Well, this next story, I have to say, is really tragic, and it was difficult to edit and then difficult to read complete. So tell us about this story, Kevin.
Yeah, so this other story, the second story, is by Uchechi Moses. And Uchechi Moses, he's a plant biologist, I believe, who was talking about COVID's effects on long-term effects for on long-term disease. Let me say that again. COVID effects on other diseases which are present. So the fact that so much attention goes into COVID and distraction to COVID, and out of necessity to handle a pandemic disease, that so many other neglected tropical diseases are not getting the attention they should get. And to start out with, you know, the neglected tropical diseases, they affect 1 billion people a year, and usually the poorest people in the world. And these are diseases that tend to be regional, maybe just in one part of Africa, one part of South America. It's estimated that 1 billion people have to wrestle with these diseases. they're typically spread by things like rats or, you know, or I should say rodents. They're zoonotic. You know, they transfer from animals to humans, to human animals. And they tend to be very underfunded and underaddressed in terms of disease. And the one that they that he really highlights is called Lassa hemorrhagic fever. Lassa affects something like 300,000 people a year, and a lot of people die from it. And it's got a broad spectrum of symptoms. It's spread by this thing called the multimammate rat. It's the natural reservoir of the disease. It's a virus called an arenavirus. These are a family of rodent-transmitted diseases in humans caused by arenaviruses, like a coronavirus, corona meaning crown, arena meaning sand. They have kind of a bumpy, gritty-looking feeling under a microscope. But the bottom line is that it's there are so many diseases like this. Junin, Machupo is in South America. These are all diseases that are also arenaviruses spread by rodents. And these are diseases that are really associated with poverty. So they don't get the West's attention. They don't get the interest of wealthy nations and are dramatically underfunded. And now COVID comes along and steals the spotlight and requires more attention. And it means that these diseases will only increase in their prevalence and in their lethality.
And I want to stress how easy it is to get these. And as I was reading up on this, as I, you know, because I was working with Uchechi to edit the story, and you know, these kids in these countries, they go out to a swimming hole or they go into the woods to play, and they come in contact with infected feces or something. It's just a total accident, and then they end up with this life changing infection. You know, and with Lassa in particular, sometimes it's just a mild fever and it's not even diagnosed. Other times, you know, you get multi-organ failure. And so there's this huge spectrum and they don't have any way to treat it or prevent it. And so I would just stress that to people listening, you know, I mean, we don't even think about diseases this way in the West. You know what I mean? I don't.
No, you're exactly right. And when one of the most sobering things for me was going to places like, you know, in Africa, I was in Uganda traveling outside of Kampala once with a friend. And you would go by the local water area, you know, the watering hole in a place with water accumulated, small creek or say somewhere between a creek and a river. And you would be on the upstream side of it and a guy walking his cattle through so that the cattle can graze on the water plants and get some water, maybe cool down a little bit. And then you drive down the river a little ways and there's a bunch of kids playing in the water. And then you go down a little bit further and there's a woman who's got big rubber boots on, who's filling containers to take home the water for the day's cooking. So you see how the lack of infrastructure can permit these vectors, these avenues of transmission very easily from people to people.
And his overall point seems to be that there's some structural issues. So you have violent conflict, you don't have a developed healthcare system, you have corrupt governments, you have inflation, and so it's hard to, let alone afford medicine, but spend money on developing the infrastructure to develop vaccines and develop treatments. And what this results in is, you know, people are poor, they need to work, and they need to accumulate wealth so they can develop that stuff, but then they get sick. And so they can't develop that stuff. And so it's this sort of tragic or vicious cycle, if you will. So I don't know if there's an easy solution. And that's one of the points he makes too, is that in the West, we sort of think that we'll just give them lots of money or we'll develop a vaccine for them. And in reality, that doesn't get to the heart of the problem.
Well, he also talks about brain drain. You know, there are brilliant scientists that come out of places like Nigeria, and which is a very developed country. And you have really sharp people who come from there. Some of the best people in my department, grad students, are from Nigeria. And you have a lot of brain drain that leaves the country because there's not sufficient infrastructure to hold them there or to, you know, continue to allow them to train to the level they wish to train. And that plus the other issue is that a lack of distribution of drugs, that everything they get in some of these very affected areas that are remote. The only drugs you can get from India or Asia, not always everything available. And the big concern is that with something like COVID-19, if there are therapeutic compounds or vaccinations that do become available, how far down the waiting list will they be as the world's poorest people in an age of America first, right? And so these are all concerns very much by the brightest minds in these countries.
He does leave on a somewhat hopeful note because he says that the economic conditions are slowly improving. So as you see some of these countries embracing market-oriented reforms, I think is the phrase he uses, they're starting to get wealthier and they're very slowly kind of crawling out of this deficit that they have. So it seems like they're going in the right direction, but we're probably looking at decades worth of development that needs to take place before you can really get a handle on diseases like the one we were talking about.
Yeah, sadly, that's true. And there's a lot of money that goes in there from Gates and other foundations, a lot of money from China investing in Africa. So it's still going to be a problem for the foreseeable future. Hopefully, as you know, communication and other infrastructure improves there, that the health conditions for the population will get better because they really deserve it.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that's one of the few silver linings of COVID is, as he says in the story, is, you know, now people are talking about it. So that's encouraging. But let's talk about pot, Kevin.
Yeah. So CRISPR for cannabis, gene edited disease resistant marijuana poised for 2021 debut. And this is by Shoshana Solomon from the Times of Israel. And, you know, you got to leave it to the potheads because it was what, you know, they do for some aspects of agriculture, what pornography did for the development of new video. like, you know, because that was a true story, right? That it was like all video was on beta cassettes back in the 70s. And that when adult film industry went on VHS, that actually drove the conversion to VHS, even though it was a less effective format. Well, and I guess it's kind of a similar analogy. For years, I would been working in the area of LED and how you grow plants under funny light conditions. And I've been getting emails from people like hightimes@aol.com. I've been getting those emails for about a decade and a half. And these guys were the cutting edge. You know, they're the ones who are really pushing it. And the reason I love this is because now you're starting to combine two different circles on the Venn diagram. And that is people who love gene editing and people who are marijuana users. I think those are somewhat discrete piles for some reason. That a lot of the folks who are anti-GMO, a lot of that tends to maybe be a little bit more likely to rip a bong load than the other type. So this story is about, and so the basic idea, this story is the thing that can make heads explode. Because here you're using genetic engineering to drive new technology that will make and enhance marijuana or cannabis. I guess it's the same thing. So this is about an Israeli company called CanBreed, clever name. They're going to be using gene editing to make better seeds or make better plants. And their whole goal is to make pot from seeds. So I'm not a big fan of this stuff, so I don't know all the details here, but they usually propagate the plants by cuttings. So you have a really good plant that makes excellent stuff, and you cut the leaves and plant them to make more cannabis plants. And that way you're able to preserve the genetics, and the seeds are not able to give fidelity in the next generation, meaning the seeds don't necessarily resemble the parent. Well, this company, CanBreed, they've managed to come up with a way to do this. And the way they do this and is probably by making F1 hybrids. And so what they're going to have are two inbred lines that when you combine them together, those lines both lend their genetics to that next generation and produce a superior product. And if you have inbred lines, so these two different parents, you can use gene editing to add or delete traits. So this is a really exciting innovation in a space that previously hasn't moved into gene editing or genetic engineering.
So I have a buddy who the other day was talking to my wife, and she was talking about how she replicates her succulents. And so she's explaining the process, and he goes, of course he's high, and he says, "Bruh, that's called cloning." And then he goes into this dissertation about how he uses it. And so just to underscore what you're saying, you know, for as high as they like to get, they are very well informed about the intricacies of plant breeding. So I found that this whole culture really fascinating, because I don't really use it either. It just doesn't agree with me. But in all seriousness, I mean, what kind of uses might result from this? Does it just mean like we're going to get a more stable supply of medical marijuana for people that need it? Is it going to be cheaper for growers, or all of the above? Or, I mean, what do you think? You're a plant guy.
Well, the first steps are going to be to solve disease resistance issues. And so marijuana is in the environments they grow it in is susceptible to something called powdery mildew. And powdery mildew is a prevalent pathogen on plants that causes a plant to decline. It puts like a powdery white substance on the leaves, which may be misinterpreted by a drug user, I guess. It puts like a powdery white fluff on the leaves, and eventually decreases the plant's growing. It, you know, it takes away from the plant's vigor, yield, all that stuff is affected. Now, there are a series of genes that are required for powdery mildew to be successfully infective in the plant, meaning that the fungus shakes hands with the plant cell and says, okay, you're the right place for me to be infecting. And if you could knock out that, let's say, receptor, you know, that plant side of the equation, and there are a series of compounds, genes, they're called MLO genes, you can disrupt those genes and break powdery mildew problems. And these have been done in things like barley. They've been done with gene editing in wheat. They've been done in strawberry by my former postdoc. And so here's a case where in pot, you can do the same thing. And so you can interrupt the gene that is necessary for powdery mildew, which is a significant pathogen, to be a problem on cannabis. So that's one really good example.
So it has some useful agronomic applications, maybe. One thing I wonder is, and maybe you don't know the answer, they didn't go into this in the story, but I wonder if drug regulation could impact research like this. I know the laws are starting to change at the state level in the U.S., but I wonder if the government could come in and say, well, you know, you can't do this, or you can only do certain things. I'm curious how that's going to influence a development like this.
Yeah, that's a good question, but this is in Israel. And Israel tends to be a little more common sense about such things, I think. Maybe I'm wrong, but at least my impression is that they tend to make a little better decisions that are science-based. You know, I don't know why I get that feeling. I know a lot of scientists over there, and I've been there, and I really just get a very good vibe of the way they think about science. The idea here is that I think it would be more trait-based rather than species-based. So if you can eliminate a gene that allows for fungal susceptibility, for instance, that may go into one category. But if you're altering genes to change the metabolism of cannabinoids, or maybe increasing delta 9 or some of the ones, you know, changing the THC levels, now all of a sudden, now maybe you're crossing a line there, because now you're actually making a more potent drug by manipulating the plant. And so maybe that's where they would start to look at that a little more critically.
That's interesting. So that's a whole nother side of this that we've yet to explore. I really am curious now how this turns out. But I guess the overall point I would say is it speaks to how useful this technology can be, even if you're not a pot smoker. Like, I'm definitely not one. but you can just see how you can use a technology like this for very practical reasons. It takes it out of this sort of abstract realm where most people think of it, if they think of it at all. And then you go, oh, look, you know, better marijuana or better tomatoes. I just think that's a important thing to walk away with.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it gives another sector that was not necessarily warm and cozy with genetic engineering, something to get a little warm and cozy about. And it's actually in 1999, I bought the domain frankenpot.com. And my idea back then was that I would come up with a website that said, we're working on the science of genetically engineering marijuana. We're going to make it more potent and have more THC and not detectable by dogs or whatever. And the idea was, you can see where I'm going, right? That it seemed like the folks who were most opposed to genetic engineering back then were also the same folks who had no problem, rolling a fat one. And so I thought, well, this would be a great opportunity for me to make some critical thinking happen, and let's just build that website. And I bought the domain and I never took it any further.
That's a brilliant strategy. Maybe we could do like a genetically modified patchouli oil and essential oils, and we could end the whole anti-GMO movement in a week.
Essential oils. Yeah, that's a really good idea. I always said that I lived my entire life without essential oils, making them probably optional oils.
As we wrap up, I just got to say, a couple years ago, I had an upper respiratory tract infection. As it turned out, I didn't know. I thought it was a canker sore, but it was a bad bacterial infection. And my mom was like, oh, here's some eucalyptus oil. You just dab it on the sore and it'll help. And I ended up in an emergency clinic 24 hours later. And the doctor's like, yeah, this would have closed off your throat. So here's an antibiotic in your butt cheek so you don't die. Anyways. So what's up with Talking Biotech? I won't say anything. You can tell people about it.
Well, this week it's up to Stuart Strand, and this week he's the professor from Washington, or University of Washington, who has invented a series of plants that detoxify indoor air. So indoor air is loaded with stuff like formaldehyde, chloroform, other types of volatile compounds that do have a relative risk in human physiology. And as we begin to button up our homes and have more energy efficiency, he feels this is becoming an increasing problem. So he's created plants that actually clean the air. And he's a very interesting guy, his second time on, and he's looking for some assistance in funding the work because nobody else is getting too excited about it. So really, really cool talk this week on Talking Biotech.
Very cool. As always, go check it out and connect with us on Twitter at Kevin Folta, at KMJ English, geneticliteracyproject.org, and we will see you next time.